Gibbs, founder of Incandescent Public Relations, publisher of Being Incandescent Business Magazine, and your host for the Incandescent Entrepreneur Show on the Incandescent Radio Network, the voice of entrepreneurs. Hi, this is Hope Katz Gibbs, and we are thrilled to be here today in San Francisco with Mel and Patricia Ziegler, founders of Banana Republic and authors of the great new book, Wild Company, The Untold Story of Banana Republic. We are very excited to listen to what that is, so welcome to the Incandescent Entrepreneur Show.
Thanks, Hope.
Nice to be here, Hope.
So let's start off by talking about Banana Republic. Tell us how you founded it. What happened? You were both working at the San Francisco Chronicle at the time. Mel was a reporter and Patricia was an illustrator. So take us back to the beginning.
The beginning was really when I met you at the Christmas party, and I knew we were going to be out of there a lot sooner than a lot of our fellow workers.
Didn't take long,
but we had to wait for the idea.
We just felt the roof over our heads. It was a great job, and people would die for jobs like this. And it was wonderful in some ways, but it still was a job. And I don't think some people are just born to be unemployable. And I'm one, and I think Patricia to some degree is. So we wanted to do something on our own. And I happened to be on a freelance assignment in Australia, where I picked up in a disposal store, which is what they call their surplus stores. I found an old British bomber jacket, and I brought it back to San Francisco. Patricia met me at the airport, and she was staring at the jacket the whole way home. And I knew,
darling, I was staring at you too. I hadn't seen you in 2 weeks, which was the longest, and we were still so in love.
I know. Well, the jacket became the company. I mean, that company really seemed. I mean, that jacket seemed the whole idea. We were looking for an idea, and everywhere I went, people would say, "Where did you get that jacket? That's a fantastic jacket." It was this sort of quintessential safari jacket, but it was made for the British Army. It was worn by British troops in the Burmese theater in the Second World War. Patricia changed the buttons, added some leather trims. It looked really great, and so we went looking for more. And I used my skills as a reporter. And Patricia used her skills as a fashion designer. She, when I met her, looked like she dressed, looked like she shopped on Madison Avenue. And I would compliment her on what she wore, and everything was from the flea market or from a secondhand store. Oh, this belt, I got it for 10 cents.
So I was right at home looking through surplus warehouses. We found one of the biggest ones right across the bay in Oakland. And we went over there to find to do our first buy. This time we had $1,500 saved up from our paychecks, and went and had recently also quit the paper on the same day, just on a leap of faith, we were going to do something bigger. And we took a trip across the bay to look through the warehouse and decided that we really had no credentials. What were we going to tell this dealer? We didn't have a surplus store. We worked in the retail business. And so Mel decided that I should be an heiress that wanted to open a little boutique, and that he would be my indulgent husband. So we walked into this cavernous, dark, dank warehouse, and this 300-pound man with a cigar in his mouth waddled toward us, said, "Yep. Ziegler's, I guess." And
everything Patricia looked at, he would look at it and he'd say, $250. $250. I'll give you that for $250.
Yes, he walked us around in piles of khaki. And I just would look uninterested, but then I saw these shirts. And I picked up one, and the fabric was silky, and they had epaulets, and they had these wonderful emblems on the sleeves. And I looked at you, and you knew I liked these shirts. And so then I asked, I said to Zim, "Seems you have a lot of these." And by this time, I think he was just tired and said, "Okay, well, I'll give them all to you if you take them for $2. So we hemmed and hawed a little bit and got him down to, I think it was $1.75.
I think so.
And wrote him a check. And
emptied our bank account. We bought everything we had, $1,500. We bought those shirts. And they were Spanish paratrooper shirts. And we took them back to our house, and we needed to figure out how to sell them. And we there was a flea market in Marin County right across the bridge from San Francisco where we lived every Sunday, and we decided that we were going to take them there, and that's where we actually started to sell them.
But before we got a chance that night, when we unloaded the car and started washing them, we had a dinner party scheduled. And three or four of our friends invited over. One was Herbert Gold, the novelist, who always kind of dressed in safari style. And he asked where the bathroom was, and I pointed downstairs next to the washing machine. And 5 minutes later, when he came up, he was holding one of these Spanish paratrooper shirts and saying, "What is this?" Looking like he just found some great treasure. And Mel said, "Oh, those are Spanish paratrooper shirts." And Herb said, "I want one." Right away, he took off his denim shirt and started putting the shirt on.
And the sleeves fell. The sleeves only came, they come about 2 inches above the...
at least 2 inches above his wrist.
Above his wrist. So I'll get another one. Put it on. 2 inches above his wrist. And another one. And every single shirt had very short sleeves. And so, oh, that's why there was surplus.
But we had at least 500 of these shirts downstairs, so I ran over and I rolled up the sleeves to about his elbow, and I stood back and said,
Nobody
would wear those shirts, rolled out sleeves, rolled down anyway.
And then we sold them.
Yeah,
short arm Spanish paratrooper shirts.
Brilliant.
And we told the story about of you know, Franco's disdain for anyone with long arms.
How clever. No, that's the catalog, right?
You started. That was the catalog.
So tell us about the catalog and how that really started.
Well, in order we just needed some familiar ground. And I write, Patricia draws. So we gravitated back to how can we do that and sell these shirts? And so we did. We basically started, we created a little catalog. And mailed it I think we printed 500 copies, and we mailed them to our friends around the country and to people in the media. Mm-hmm. And that's basically what happened. One of them landed on the desk of a radio announcer in New York, who was reading it to commuters in the tri-state area. One morning, and he said this little company, Banana Republic, he called Banana Republic Live, he got Patricia on the phone, it was a 20-minute interview there, and she said, well, if you want a copy of the catalog, send $1, post office box, 745, Mill Valley, California, and then 2 or 3 days later, this postman walked in with two sacks of mail, and we opened those envelopes and ate dinner for months.
I love that. Looking back, do you think that kind of, clearly we own a PR firm and getting our clients in the news, but I always say, you know, it doesn't have the impact that you wish it would have. That was the impact that you wish. Do you think that's still true? Can a company really start off that way still?
Oh, I think there's so, with technology today, there's
with
so many
social
ways
media
to reach people.
Right.
And I think what happened was our catalog was so different, and it was just purely us. It was the funny stories we made up. With Mel's writing, my drawing, completely impractical, but it broke the mold, and people noticed it. And I think today you can get noticed over, you know, Instagram or, you know, Twitter.
It's much easier today.
It doesn't take money.
I see it happening. I've seen it on Instagram. I see people with followers. Suddenly they get. I mean, they've got 20,000, 30,000 followers, and a little website. People go to the website. I've seen photographers selling pictures. Our son has sold huge paintings from people who found him on Instagram. Mm-hmm. And so now you're able to make the world a little village, and people can communicate with one another in a way that we could never do that now. We wanted to get it out. We basically had to print it, put it in the mail, hope it got into the right mailbox. And if somebody wanted to order something, they had to basically find a pen and fill out the form, and then find an envelope and a stamp and a mailbox, and it wasn't just click.
Right. So you think it's easier to
Oh, it's much easier to do.
It's more crowded. The field's more crowded, but there's so many more ways to get through it.
Right. So. And you started that business before computers, too, so
yes.
Everything
yes.
was manual.
Everything yes. was manual.
Yeah, including our inventory system.
which was non-existent. We pretended to have an inventory system.
So tell us about that first store. In the book, you talk about it, and it just sounds so fabulous. It sounds scary, and how you were sort of like, it was $30 to hang a shelf, so you came up with the belt system to use, as, which was brilliant.
That's right. Well, Mel had found, he decided that we needed a store right after our first flea market experience. Found this little hole in the wall. The ceilings were only barely 7.5 feet, and it was very dark. So we rented it, used it as a place to remanufacture the clothes for the first 3 weeks, and then we knew we had to open by the day after Thanksgiving. So you have to visualize this very little space with huge telephone poles like holding the ceiling. And thinking Banana Republic, I bought some palm fronds and stuck them into the top, so it turned those into, you know, rather stout palm trees. We painted the back wall with a leopard print, and we had no dressing room and really didn't want to take any space away, so we cleaned out a closet and hung a camouflage net in front of that. And then, yes, Mel was ran to the hardware store to buy some things to for dowels or rack holders. They were too expensive, and so we found
surplus belts,
and we just nailed them to the ceiling and attached dowels.
Brilliant.
To them. And people thought they were clever. And crates, we got crates from the grocery store to use for shelving. And Mel also came in and hammered a bunch of nails into the ceiling into the beams, and that's where we hung our hats.
But well, the fedora was too modern. I don't know. One of the hats was too modern, so you.
Those were the only new things that we bought. We bought them from a wholesaler, and they were just good-looking felt hats. And got the idea again. The belts would make great hat bands. And
we got huge cache of Argentine gaucho belts used, and they did a lot of work for us.
Yeah,
that's amazing. Yeah,
but you also held up the pants for women who were just like size 4 trying to wear a man's twice 28 khaki.
We just used everything we had, which is, you know, I say in the book, you need to go with what you've got.
Right.
Too many people just sit around dreaming and trying to make things perfect. Things will never be perfect. You have to, if you're really determined, you gather yourself and just proceed.
And that is perfect. That makes it, adds the soul to it, the life of the business, and it creates itself, it sounds like.
It does create itself. It kind of told us what to do. I mean, there was really no money and no experience, but there were no limits.
Right, the customers loved it, and in relationship to those customers, we discovered what we had done.
Yeah.
By the way they reflected it back, you know, we just were good listeners, and we kept on. They would show us what we did, and then we would do more, and then we did actually more than we thought we did, and they showed back again, and we learned what our business was, and what we learned was that people really liked what we were doing because it was authentic, it was real, it was sincere, it was not what like anything that they had seen before, and so they wanted to participate and endorse this kind of thing. And it was great because of that, we were able to, to find the right kind of employees and customers. The customers became evangelists for us. We did it without advertising. Basically, it was all word of mouth and catalog that made the business what it was.
It's amazing.
In the late 70s, I think there was a hunger for something authentic again.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the 60s had disappeared, and really, it was the disco age.
Right.
You know, things were shiny and polyester and mass market was just taking off. So to find something that was more authentic and with natural materials and character and heritage. And
well, it wasn't until I read the book, and I mentioned this to you when we were talking earlier, you really, you designed the fashion for women my age in college in the 80s, in the mid-80s. I mean, those, the big shirts with the belts and the pants with the big pants with the belts and punk funky boots. That was you. I didn't realize that until I read the book that you were. Thank you. That was really fun.
It was fun, and it was inspired by the clothes before us and the age, because you know what? That was the time when the women's movement was really coming on strong,
right.
And feminism, and one of our responses to that was in clothes and the unisex look. Like, hey, well, we could wear clothes like men do in a feminine way, and I think that was part of the inspiration, the real strength.
It's also going with what we've got, because most of
the... Don't tell anyone.
That was a brilliant inspiration.
There weren't a lot of women's surplus clothes.
Yeah, not much women's.
So we had to make men's military surplus clothes fashionable for women. Talk about a challenge.
Yeah.
Patricia was up to it, though. She made it happen.
Yeah, it sounded like the team effort was just tremendous. I mean, 1 + 1 = 10, it sounds like, what you created there. So before we want to talk about what happened and you selling eventually to The Gap, let's talk a little bit about the spirit that you brought to that business, about what you really wanted. What I loved in the book is when you said, all right, we're going to quit our jobs and we're going to write down the three things, because you were looking at a business book, right? So you bought a business book and you wrote down three things, and you both wrote independently the same three things. So talk about that and what your true dream was for what you hope to accomplish.
What we wanted was independence. What we wanted was freedom. We just wanted to do what we wanted to do. And I think that drove us more than anything. So we had to find a way to do that. And we had to find a way to do this that was natural. And we didn't have any business education. I never took it. I mean, I have a master's degree, but I never took a business course. I mean, I'm a journalist. Patricia's an artist. We found a book called, it's an old classic book, Napoleon Hill, Think and Grow Rich. And in it, and looked at it, and he suggests three things. What was it? Write down...
How much money do you want to make?
No, that was the third thing. Okay. How much money do you want to make? How long do you want to make it? How long do you want to take
yourself
to make it? And
how,
then,
what
and
are
what are you
going
to do to make it?
Yeah.
Okay, well, let's figure that one out. So we both said, it was 1970, we said $1 million.
But I remember
we
went to our two different chairs in the kitchen. We each had a little piece of paper and separately wrote down $1 million, which was probably an obvious thing everybody wanted to make.
Right.
And we were patient. We said 5 years.
Yeah.
That's right. And then what? The what was the difficult part?
The what you wanted to do.
Yeah, we didn't know what we didn't have any clue what we were doing.
No, it's okay. Keep talking. But I love that you, in the end, you did it. You made $1 million more, I'm sure. You did it within a short period of time.
Five years was when we sold the business.
Yes. So you really, thought back at when after I finished the book, and I thought back, and I think you got it. You did exactly what you wanted.
I think that's true. If you want to succeed in anything, you need to put your intention out there and start moving towards it. I mean, that's the way you do it.
And it's an intention, not really a goal. I think that's misleading. A goal kind of makes you just looking at the end.
Right.
But intention kind of is your driver going through.
Yeah.
So we had a very clear vision of how we wanted to live our life. And I think that intention was so strong that it drove us in and out of business.
So talk about that. So eventually The Gap came to you and...
Well, we got ahead of ourselves. I mean, we were overwhelmed by success. I mean, knowing nothing, we had more business that we could handle on an ongoing basis. So we really never quite caught up with ourselves. And again, these were different times. These weren't times when you actually went out and found a venture capitalist to finance a quirky little business. Nothing like that was happening in the 1970s. Banks wouldn't talk to us. They laughed at
us.
So we had no capital. And we were doing this all on cash flow. I mean, it was a retail business. And what came in today went out tomorrow to buy more surplus. And then that went out. And so we were just always chasing after.
It doesn't feel good, does it?
It felt good, but we were exhausted. We just kept working, and we worked around the clock. It was like one long day, 5 years. It never ended.
And as the business started developing, we saw, well, this is really kind of a safari, classic style business. There's so many other pieces of clothing that we should be selling, but we didn't have the capacity to manufacture them. I mean, to be able to buy fabric and, you know, the timeline, there was no way that we could take that on with the capital that we had. So that became one of the things. If we were going to grow bigger, we needed to manufacture. We'd also needed to open more stores, which were capital intensive too. And
the only way we were going to be able to afford the kind of people we needed who knew how to run the business was to get more money. And so it just for serendipitously at that point, somebody was a mutual friend of us and Don Fisher, who basically is the founder of The Gap and started The Gap, suggested that we meet him. And we did. We hit it off. And then he wanted to buy the company, and I was very reluctant. I said, you know, no, I can't imagine. I mean, even as hard as it was, I could not imagine working for The Gap. It wasn't really, when you start out thinking all you want is freedom and independence and you end up working for The Gap, you've done something wrong. So I didn't really want to do that. And he was very persuasive. He said, I don't want to run your company. You know, you can run your company. You can do anything you want with your company. I'll just finance it. As long as you're profitable, I'll finance anything you want to do. And I said, well, you know, we'd have to have total creative autonomy. He said, okay, you're going to have total creative autonomy. And so he made it very easy to say yes, except when we were so exhausted.
He hit you when you were down.
Right. So I, by a vote of one yes and one maybe, we decided to sell.
Yeah. And I love the story about the attorney that you hired, a man with all heart and not so much all your help, but it worked. Yeah. But it's such, you know, kind of, how old were you at the time?
30.
Okay. So, you
I should have known better.
30, you think?
30-year-old today would know better, but he was a wonderful person. He was a dear friend.
Dear friend of a friend of ours.
And became a dear friend of ours.
Yes.
And was a wonderful human being. He just didn't have any experience in this field.
But dealing with him, we went in believing that you could do business in a very honorable, straightforward way. What there wasn't anything mysterious about it. It was very gentlemanly.
Yeah.
And that's how we went in. But we were not ready for corporate America.
Yeah. So do you regret it?
No, because we believed in the way he did it, and he was representing us.
I don't think we have any regrets.
Yeah.
I mean, we have no regrets. It all worked out perfectly fine.
Yeah. So tell us about the moment in time when you had your one-month-old infant in your hands and everything changed.
Well, by then we had 101 stores. We were doing $250 million in business. All of it based on that conversation with Don. But then all of a sudden the Gap, because it was Black Friday, I think it was Black Monday, 1987, where the stock market crashed, and the Gap stock had fallen the month before. It had missed earnings, and the stock had fallen by a half, and then it fell by another half on Black Monday, and they started to panic.
They wanted to see what we were going to offer for the spring line. All of a sudden, they were very nosy about the creative side of the business.
And we reminded them, this isn't really what this is all about. But they had the keys. And so we said, you can have them.
A couple of weeks off, and our son was born. I came back in the office with him in my arms, and I see Mel in the conference room with Don and Mickey Drexler, and I just walked in. I had Zio in her arms, and you could just feel the air in the room.
In any event, it was the time was up. we had creative autonomy as long as we had creative autonomy. The moment we didn't have it, we say goodbye. Freedom is what we were in it for, not money. And we walked away from huge, huge
we had just
amount of money.
Another 5-year
you know, that would have been, that really would have made us comfortable for life in ways that we never even imagined or wanted to be.
But that was a conscious choice.
Yeah.
It was a conscious choice when you look at a contract to make this money and give up your freedom.
Took the
or
freedom.
Walk away with freedom when you have enough.
We felt
for
great.
Us.
We felt great about
There's
it.
There's no question.
We felt badly about the people who were with us because they then had to deal with
the fallout.
This.
Oh,
and the next day were the next one.
Such a great team.
And the Gap managed to just eviscerate the entire team and change it over. But out of that, many entrepreneurs bloomed. They learned, they said, well, Mel and Patricia could do it, we could do it. And that really happened. And so we were very proud.
Debbie went out and started her own food business.
Yes.
I think both of our designers started their own clothing businesses.
Yes.
Nancy, I think, had her own.
There were many.
Julie wrote a book.
Countless.
Everybody.
Wow.
And that's that we are great proud.
Yes.
Great pride in that to see that happen.
Wow. But that wasn't the end.
No, I was just going to say, even our store, and a lot of our store personnel even went out and started the business. We had very creative people running, people that were part-time actors and actresses and musicians and did things with passion, loved working for the company, even in the stores. And, it was a great spirit. It was fun to go to work.
And all this is explained in the book, and you, really, I encourage everyone to read this book because it reads like a novel. It's the back and forth. You write, you start off Mel writing, and it's got the typewriter, and then when Patricia's voice comes in, the type font changes, and then it's the artist palette. And it's this back and forth story that you can't, I read it in one sitting. You can't put that book down. So
Thank you.
I highly encourage, it's the best business book I have read in a long time, so
Thank
it's
you.
Really
Thank
enchanting
you.
And engaging, as are you. But we're not done yet. So tell us, you didn't stop. So you finished that, you took a little break, and then suddenly the Republic of Tea was born.
Yes,
well,
Mel decided to go away on a meditation retreat for a week. And we were both coffee drinkers at that point. The next thing I knew, he came home with, he was only drinking tea.
Well, what happened is they didn't have coffee at this meditation retreat. So I had this excruciating headache, a coffee withdrawal headache the second day of the retreat. It was probably the worst headache I've ever had in my entire life. And when that headache lifted, I said, I'm never going to drink this black swill again in my life. And instantly, the idea for a tea business popped into my head. So I said, we're going to do a tea business. I came home from the retreat. I said, let's start a tea business.
Yeah.
And so like anything else, I mean, we use businesses to learn. We learned about tea. We loved it. We explored it. It's a wonderful product. And we learned all about it and started a business called the Republic of Tea.
Yes, yeah, so we wanted to package it in a way that would stand out on the shelf and be in a recycled package, something you would use again and again. We found that tea had been stored in tins. So we found these wonderful round tins where we could print our own labels on each one to give it that artisan kind of feel. And I remember that we had to pay, there was a decision. We really wanted these tins, but until the quantity jumped up, they cost us like $1. But we figured
tins cost more than the tea.
More than the tea, but we figured, okay, well, we're going to make this. If this tea company works, then we will be able to buy the larger volume. So we gambled on that.
And it was very playful. It still is. It's very play. I mean, the Republic of Tea has continued in the same spirit, unlike Banana Republic. We don't own it any longer. We sold that, but it's continued in the same spirit. I was the Minister of Leaves.
Mm-hmm.
Patricia was the Minister of Enchantment. The company now is. Doesn't have employees as ministers. Everybody is, it's a lovely company, and it continues to this day. And basically, there was no specialty tea category at that time. If you wanted to buy tea at that time when we started about 25 years ago. You go to this market and you could either buy Celestial Seasonings, which was a hippie company in Boulder that sold herbal teas, and Lipton, which, or Twinings tea, and that was it. There were no other teas on the shelf. And Republica Tea came in with 21 tins of full leaf tea, and it changed the entire business. Now, if you go into a Whole Foods, you'll see there's a whole section of specialty teas. They all came out of the Republic of Tea.
You
create a context.
Yeah.
I think that's what we did in both instances that you're speaking about, is that we created a context, and it was the context in which the business fit. I mean, we just didn't try to fit the business into an existing context. We wanted to go out and make a new context, and then create a business that represented that context.
True entrepreneurs.
We imagined a world, and here we were, new parents. We imagined a slower world instead of gulp by gulp, it was a sip by sip life. And you took your time and you noticed, and you sipped tea.
Amazing. I love it. And then what came? Then Zoza.
Oh, we had a, we, yeah, we had a.
We did a couple of preschools in between.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
With friends.
We intentionally set out. We had children late in our life, and we wanted to spend as much time with them as possible. And we were lucky enough to be financially independent because of Banana Republic. So we just didn't feel like we had to run out there and repeat again and again and again the same movie. And what we wanted to do was really enjoy our two children, who are now 21 and 25. So we're the kind of parents who have absolutely no regrets. We were there all the time. And we are a very close family. Love our kids immensely, and it was great fun. So I mean, basically, you know, we went from having 3,000 kids to two kids, and those two kids were much more of a handful than the 3,000 kids. And now they're young, thriving adults, and we're very happy about that. So we would dip in and dip out of things, and one of the things we dipped in and out of was a 1999 in San Francisco was like 1849 in San Francisco. The gold rush was on, except it was the dot-com stuff that they were mining. And we got swept up in it along with everybody else. I mean, the venture capital money was throwing money all over the place. We had an idea to do a...
First, Ed came to us and said, let's do something together again. Now, Ed was our COO at Banana Republic. So he said, we had so much fun. Let's do something again.
And we wanted to play with him again.
Yeah.
So we decided, okay, let's do something. So we invented a business called Zoza. And it created a whole new line of clothes. By that point, because we've been out... Banana Republic was all about natural fabrics, cotton, really beautiful cotton and wool. But in the intervening years, we live on a mountain and we're very outdoorsy. I'd started wearing a lot of Patagonia clothes and a lot of performance clothes because I ride a bike and I hike, and I really saw the virtue of performance fabrics. So we decided to start a business to where we would marry Patagonia with Prada.
Ah.
And that's what Zoza was all about. It was all about design using these high-tech fabrics.
Wow.
And it was sort of almost a yoga baseline.
Yeah, it sounds like Lululemon a little bit.
In fact, we had free yoga classes in the office in the mornings. You would leave your shoes by the door when you came to work. It's all just white carpeted. We had free yoga class.
And a company Zen master.
Yes.
I mean, my friend Norman Fisher, high school friend, was also the abbot of the San Francisco Zen Center. He became the abbot of Zoza as well. So we play,
and we opened the offices very right across the freeway from our kids were going to school, so we could pick them up after school, and they would come in and help. They were still like 12 and 8 at the time.
So we had a great time with that. And unfortunately, when the dot-com wave swept through San Francisco, everything. I mean, it was in those days. It cost $5 million to build a website that today cost $5,000 to build. So it took so much capital at that point, and when the March 2000 came, and the NASDAQ started to really dive, and people started to panic, all financing dried up, and we were deep in it. So like a number of other dot-com companies that, of that age, we were just swept out to sea. We had
our fabric, you know, waiting to go to manufacturing, and we didn't get our second round because our investment banker was losing it on another business. So we were just caught high and dry.
Yeah.
Money dried up.
So what do you do with all that stuff that you have sitting in a warehouse?
No, we had to.
We sold it. We liquidated it. Well,
you've seen the highs and the lows.
No, I mean, I like to say that the seed of success is in every failure, mm-hmm. and the seed of failure is in every success.
It's
definitely true.
Yeah.
Because you can, through success, you can get a little bit too arrogant, and in failure, you're gonna, if you're failing correctly, you'll get very enterprising.
Yes, that's amazing. So what, can you give us 5 tips for entrepreneurs based on what you've learned?
Go with what you've got.
I like that one. That's a good one.
Be the customer. So if you're making things for yourself, you never have a doubt about how it should be done and what it should be.
Nice.
Turn your liabilities into your assets. What you think is wrong, there's something right about it. And make it work. It's not, because if something's in your way, find the gift in it.
Mm-hmm. Can you give us an example of that?
Oh, I think our entire surplus line of clothing was exactly that. I mean, it was, we would get things like French firefighter coats made out of asbestos, but the lining would be this beautiful silk quilting. So we would tear out the asbestos and make purses out of the quilting.
Brilliant. Yeah.
And even the fact that the clothes were all for men forced us to have to style it from women and come up with a new look.
Nice. Yeah.
I mean, the surplus itself is a liability. That's why governments get rid of it. So we built the business on turning liabilities into assets.
Awesome. How about a couple more?
Well, only don't accept no, only as an inconvenience. Because there is always a way to do something.
And you can't make mistakes. There's no such thing as a mistake. You just move on.
And the final one is just never give up.
Never give up.
Well, and I have one more. This one really jumped out at me.
Oh, okay.
You tell this story at the end. It's not about winning. It's about playing. Tell us the story where you came up mm-hmm. with that idea.
Oh, my son was about a year, he was just beginning to stand, about a year, a little bit more than a year, year and a half old. And we were playing with a ball, a beach ball. And I was tossing him the beach ball, and he would catch the beach and back and forth. And I wanted to teach him how to catch. And so I set his hands up, and I said, now when the ball comes really close, you just squeeze and the ball. And I threw it to him, and to his utter surprise and delight, he caught it. And so he jumped up and down, and he said, I caught it, I caught it, I caught it. So I said, great, let's do it again. Again, I set him up, tossed him the ball, he squeezed his hands too soon, and the ball fell on the deck. And he jumped up and down and said, I missed it, I missed it. And in that instant, he taught me that it's all about playing. And kids can do that. They really see it clearly. It's the day that counts. It's all we have. It's the journey. We've heard it said in many, many different ways. The journey is the goal.
Yeah. Amazing. Well, thank you both so much for being with us. It was incredible to meet you. I have been admiring your work for years unknowingly. And now I highly recommend that everyone reads Wild Company, The Untold Story of Banana Republic. Mel and Patricia Ziegler will be our cover story in the May 2013 issue of Being Candescent magazine. And we look forward to lots of people reading about you and reading your book. And we look forward to everything that you're doing next. Last question before we go, what are you doing next?
Well, we are doing slow food for fast lives. We are trying to make a healthy alternative for our on-the-go lifestyle. And our first product will be out this summer.
Excellent. What is the name of the company?
It's called Eat True. and it's EATRUE, and it is, and we're going to be selling bars that are like mini meals, Italian, Japanese, Moroccan. Instead of these energy bars, which are really kind of glorified candy bars, you'd be able to eat something that's healthy, nutritious, tastes good. It's artisan food, and it'll be on the shelf next to the energy bars. And so, that'll be the beginning of a number of products where we try to explore the idea of slow food for fast lives, because that's how people are living. And I think there's a huge demand these days for nutritious, healthy food and not this kind of junk fast food.
So if you're not in the mood for a candy bar style energy bar, you can look for our Indian Eat True bar with coconut, curry, cashews, carrots, cauliflower, savory artisan experience.
Excellent. More trend setting from the Zieglers. Well, we look forward to talking to you more about that when that company is flourishing. And we hope to have you back on the show. So that's it for today for the Incandescent Entrepreneur Show on the Incandescent Radio Network. Thank you for being with us, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thank you.
Thank you. That's very nice.
So that's it for today's Incandescent Entrepreneur Show, where we always ask, what's your story? If you have a good one and would like to be interviewed on the Incandescent Entrepreneur Show, send me an email to hope@hopegibbs.com. Check back every Monday at noon for a new episode of the Incandescent Entrepreneur Show on the Incandescent Radio Network, www.incandescentradio.com. We look forward to talking to you next week. Here's to your incredible, indelible success.